Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 8. I'm going to cover the first 21 verses of that chapter. We will call it the Ark brought into the temple. Our context is this. In our last chapter, the temple furnishings were described as they were built by Hiram of Tyre. And in 1 Kings chapter 7, the last chapter, also Solomon's palace was described. In chapter 6 of 1 Kings, Solomon had built the temple. Now, everything having been constructed, we're now going to see the ark brought in the temple, and in our next audio, we'll see the temple dedicated. So we start now in 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the ark of the Lord's covenant from Zion, the city of David. All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon at the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month. When all the elders of Israel had arrived, the priest took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the sacred furnishings in it. The priest and Levites carried them up, and King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that had gathered about him were before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and cattle that they could not be recorded or counted. Now there was a solemn procession to bring up the ark. This is the ark that had been put in a special tent by David. He had brought up the ark previously from Kiriath-Jearim, where the Israelites had taken the ark through a series of circumstances from the Philistines, who had taken it from the Israelites at the Battle of Shiloh when Eli lost the ark. So the ark is being looked after in Kiriath-Jearim, and now it's being brought and up to the to Jerusalem from Kiriath-Jearim, which was to the west of Jerusalem, and was going to be put in the temple. Now, there was a procession here, and we see all the heads of the tribes. That's the 12 tribes, the chief of the Israelites' families. The tribes were divided into families or clans, and those leaders, too, went. And so here is the order of march. The kings and the elder, the king, Solomon, he went first, and then the elders, that would be the leaders of the 12 tribes, and the priests came, then the Levites. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says concerning this, quote, "The lead was taken by the king and elders of the people, whose march must have been slow, as priests were stationed to offer an immense number of sacrifices at various points in the line of road through which the procession was to go. Then came the priest bearing the ark and the tabernacle, the old Mosaic tabernacle which was brought from Gibeon." I need to stop here. The ark was at Kiriath-Jearim, and the tabernacle separated from the ark was at Gibeon, which was about 4 or 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Two different places. Jameson Fawcett and Brown continue. "Lastly, the Levites followed, carrying the vessels and ornaments belonging to the old for lodgment in the new house of the Lord. There was a slight deviation in this procedure from the order of march established in the wilderness," that's in Numbers, "but the spirit of the arrangement was duly observed." So the ark's going to end up in the Holy of Holies of Solomon's temple, and the old tabernacle is going to end up stored somewhere in the storage rooms of the new temple. And it all comes in a big procession into Jerusalem. Now the ark was brought from Zion, the city of David. Of course, Zion is the city of David. That's one use of the word Zion. The city of David is that hill that juts out from Mount Moriah at the north, going down to the Valley of Hinnom in the south, surrounded by the Tyrrhenian Valley to the west and the Kidron Valley to the east. That's the city of David, or Zion, or Mount Zion. Now, since the temple was built on Mount Moriah, the ark is going just a little bit north from the city of David in Zion to Mount Moriah, which is just to the north, maybe to the northwest a little bit of the city of David, Mount Zion. So it wasn't a long procession. Now, when did this take place? Verse 2, "All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon." Well, before I go there, let me talk about the men of Israel. That refers to the common people, too, in addition to all the elders. So this was a public procession with everybody, not just the big shots. They came together at the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim. Now, Ethanim is one of the 4 month names of the Hebrew calendar that are Canaanite, pre-exilic names. Let me give you those four. The first month was Abib, which in the normal calendar is Nisan. Before the exile, the months were called the first month, second month, third month, except with the exception of these four that I'm about to give you. That's before the Babylonian exile. After the exile, the Jews used Babylonian names for the months. And so the first month, the Canaanite name was Abib. The Babylonian name was Nisan. The second month, the Canaanite name was Ziv, or Ziph. The Babylonian name was Iyar, I-Y-Y-A-R. The seventh month was named Ithanim, and that's the one that's mentioned here. That's the Canaanite name, and the Babylonian name is Tishri. The eighth month is Bul, Canaanite name, and the Babylonian name is Marheshvan. Well, we're now in the seventh month, the month of Ethanim, the month of Tishri, as it's most commonly known. That's September and October by the solar calendar, by the Julian calendar, our calendar. Our calendar is not the Julian calendar, but the modern-day calendar. Now, what does this tell us, this fact that this temple dedication is taking place in the seventh month? Well, we know from 1 Kings 6:38 that the temple was finished in the eighth month, the month of Bul. And now this dedication is taking place in the seventh month. Well, that means that it took 11 months after the finishing of the temple before the dedication to take place. We read in 1 Kings 6:38, in his, Solomon's 11th year, in the eighth month, in the month of Bul, the temple was completed in every detail according to every specification. So there was an 11-month delay. Now, the very next year was a jubilee year, which is a very appropriate time to dedicate the temple. This is all from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, especially if the feast was the Feast of Tabernacles, the feast that's mentioned here in verse 2. At the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim, the ark was brought. I believe it was the Feast of Tabernacles. There's a couple of other options, but the most probable is the Feast of Tabernacles. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, that if the feast was the Feast of Tabernacles, quote, that feast had, quote, been instituted in commemoration of the Israelites dwelling in booths during their stay in the wilderness, as well as of the tabernacle, which was then erected. So the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, refers to the tabernacles the Israelites lived in as they were going through the Exodus, but also the tent of God where he lived during the Exodus, which was the tabernacle. So the Feast of Booths satisfies the tabernacle. And of course, the temple is the fulfillment of the tabernacle. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue that God had promised to meet and dwell with his people in that tabernacle, sanctifying it with his glory. As the tabernacle was to be superseded by the temple, there was admirable propriety in choosing the Feast of Tabernacles as the period for dedicating the new place of worship, and praying that the same distinguished privileges might be continued to it in the manifestation of the divine presence and glory. Feast of Tabernacles celebrates the tabernacles, and the temple is the fulfillment of the tabernacle. So that makes sense. Now, I said that the Feast of Tabernacles is probably the feast that's being referred to here in verse 2 as to when this dedication, this moving of the ark, took place. That's only one of three options. Let's go through the three main Jewish festivals in Tishri, Ethanim, month 7 of the religious year of the Jews. Tishri 1 is Rosh Hashanah, the new year. That's a one-day festival. Yom Kippur, Tishri 10, the Day of Atonement. And Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, which is Tishri 15 through 21. Now, Adam Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown think that this is the feast that's being referred to, and I do too. It just seems more appropriate. I mean, Tishri 10, the Day of Atonement, is kind of somber. But anyway, we don't know for sure. Now, let's go to verse 3. When all the elders of Israel had arrived in Jerusalem, the priest took up the ark. Now, that's a little bit problematic, the priest taking up the ark. Why is that? Because it's usually the Levites that take up the ark. And in fact, another problem, 2 Chronicles 5:4 says the Levites picked up the ark. Let me read that, 2 Chronicles 5:4. All the elders of Israel came, and the Levites picked up the ark. That's the parallel passage in Chronicles. Well, I'm going to give you 5 possible ways to reconcile the fact that King says the priest carried the ark, and Chronicles says the Levites carried the ark. Option number 1, every priest was a Levite, although not vice versa, but every priest is a Levite. Comes from the tribe of Levi, he's from the family of Aaron, which makes him particular, but he is from the tribe of Levite, as the other Levites are. So you could say 2 Chronicles 5:4 refers to priest, not the Levites picking up the ark. 2 Chronicles 5:4, all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites who were priests, implied, picked up the ark, and so you have no contradiction. I think that's weak. Second way to reconcile, this is from Josephus. The priest brought the ark, and the Levites brought the vessels. But the problem with that is the passage says all the elders of Israel came and the Levites picked up the ark. It doesn't say the Levites picked up the vessels. I don't think that's a good solution either. Option number three. This is from the commentator Benson. The Levites carried the ark and the priests installed the ark in the new Holy of Holies. Now that was standard procedure in the times of the tabernacle in the Exodus. The priests would break down the ark in the Holy of Holies so the Levites couldn't go in there. They would break the ark down and get it packed up, and then the Levites would pick it up and carry it. So the priests and Levites would work together. That was the only time the priests could go into the Holy of Holies, is when they were moving. Otherwise, it was only once a year the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies, but the ordinary priest could go in there to break the ark down and move it. I don't have the site for that. I'm speaking from memory, but I know that's true. So this is a simple reconciliation. The Levites carried the ark, and the priest took the ark when it got there, and they put it in the new Holy of Holies. That's pretty good reconciliation. Fourth possibility, the priest helped carry the ark, so both the priest and the Levites carried the ark. Now, priests could carry the ark. They've already done so on special occasions. Three times before this, when they crossed the Jordan, the priest carried the ark across the Jordan. When they marched around Jericho, the priest carried the ark then, not just the Levites. How about in David's flight from Absalom's rebellion, when David decided to send the ark back into Jerusalem by Zadok and Abiathar, the two high priests at the time? Those two priests carried the ark. They were high priests, so there's nothing wrong with the priest carrying the ark. So it could be that both of them did it. Here's option number five. The priests were the principals and the Levites were the agents. This is my solution. I didn't read this anywhere, so you can take this with a grain of salt. The priests brought it back in, but they got the Levites to do the work for them. Just like I say, I built my house. I didn't build my house. I hired a contractor to build it. At any rate, the ark gets back to Jerusalem, the priests and the Levites helping in some fashion. Now, verse 4 mentions the tent of meeting. And they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting. Now, the tent of meeting is most probably the tabernacle that had gone through the Exodus and had been stored up there at Gibeon. I forgot when the ark, the tabernacle ended up at Gibeon. I think it had been moved from Shiloh when Eli collapsed the high priesthood there with his son's immorality and losing the battle to the Philistines and losing the ark. And we sort of lose sight of the tent of meeting, but I think it's been speculated that somehow the tent of meeting migrated on down to Gibeon, and that's where it was. We know it was in Gibeon because it's stated there in some other places, but how it got there is a little bit in the dark, if my memory serves me correctly. Now, I said that's most probably what it is. There's another possibility. Remember when David brought the ark from Kiriath-Jearim during his reign, he made a special tent for the ark, which was separate from the tabernacle in Gibeon. And so Adam Clark points out that we're not really sure what's being referred to here in verse 4 that was being carried back into Jerusalem to be installed into the temple. Is it the tent of meeting at Gibeon, or is it the special tent that David had built and was housing the ark in Jerusalem? Quote from Adam Clark, quote, which of these tabernacles was brought into the temple at this time is not well known. Some think both were brought in order to prevent the danger of idolatry. I should rather suppose that the tabernacle from Gibeon was brought in and that the temporary one erected by David was demolished. A lot of speculation there. We don't know. It doesn't really matter. We go now to verse 4, or still in verse 4. Not only the ark came into Jerusalem, not only the tent of meeting, but all the sacred furnishings in the tent of meeting came. And that's why, well, I say in the tent of meeting, I'm assuming it's the temple tent of meeting, the tabernacle at Gibeon that's being talked about here. And it makes sense here. You got the sacred furnishings mentioned in the same breath with the tent of meeting. It makes sense that's the tabernacle at Gibeon, which I think most commentators think. So all the sacred furnishings are coming to, this is what Ellicott says, quote, all was probably deposited as a sacred relic of antiquity somewhere in the precincts of the temple. Remember all those storage rooms on the side of the temple that we talked about in chapter 6, 1 Kings? Well, this is where the golden branch candlestick was probably put, the table of showbread, the golden altar of incense, the bronze altar. I'm sure they stored it in those storerooms. Barnes says the sacred furnishings were probably placed in the treasury. I don't know, that seems sort of like a strange place to put it if you ask me. I guess it did have some value, but at any rate, it was stored. And Benson said the reason that all the sacred furnishings were stored was to prevent all idolatrous and superstitious use of those sacred furnishings. We go now to 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 6 through 9. The priest then brought the Ark of the Lord's Covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place. Remember, the most holy place is the, now it's 20 by 20 by 20, cubit cube at the west end of the temple. And the holy place, not the most holy place, but the holy place, is the 40 by 20 rectangular room where the 12 seven-branch candlesticks were placed and the 12 tables of showbread were placed. In the temple, not the tabernacle, of course, but the temple. All right, so the ark was put in the most holy place, and I've been calling the most holy place the Holy of Holies, as some translations have it. The ark was then put beneath the wings of the cherubim, it says in verse 6. Now, those cherubim in chapter 6 we saw had their wings extended from wall to wall of the temple, 5 cubits by 5 cubits on one side of one cherubim, 5 cubits on the other side, that's 10, and then the other cherubim had 5 and 5 on left and right. You put those together, you got 20 cubits wide, wings all the way across. Verse 7, the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. All right, so the ark was put probably under the rightmost wingtip of the northernmost cherubim and the leftmost wingtip of the southernmost cherubim. If you can place that, remember the temple is facing east. I just was listening to a medieval papacy podcast and I learned something new, that when a medieval Catholic temple or cathedral could not be placed east because of building constraints or location constraints, they would face it to another direction and call that other direction liturgical east, even though it was pointed to geographical north. Kind of interesting. But anyway, temples go to the east. So you got these cherubim stretching their wings out, and the ark is probably under the rightmost wingtip of the northern angel and the leftmost wingtip of the southern angel. So the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. The poles were left in the ark as the ark was placed into the Holy of Holies. That didn't happen in the tabernacle. They would pull the poles out. There wasn't enough room in that smaller tent, but they kept the poles in the ark in the temple. Verse 8. Now, verse 8 is so complicated. I have just spent 2 hours trying to figure out verse 8. I'm going to try to make it clear to you as I go through this, but let me just read it now. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they're still there today. Verse 9, there was nothing in the ark except the 2 stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. Now notice in verse 6 that the priests have gone into the most holy place. We tend to think, well, most holy place, nobody can go in there but the high priest once a year on the Day of Atonement. But that's not precisely true. Here's what John Gill says, quote, for though into it, into the Holy of Holies, none but the high priest might enter, and he but once a year, yet in case of necessity, as for the repair of it, or the repair of the Holy of Holies, which the Jews gather from hence, other priests might enter, as was the case now. In other words, in the Old Testament law, priests could go in to repair. I think that's in the law and not in the custom. I think that's in the law, but I know they went in there to break down the ark and to move the ark and pack it up for travel. So the Jews figured from that, well, on special occasions, the priest, no ordinary priest, can go into the Holy of Holies. Gill continues, a high priest could not carry the ark himself, and therefore it was necessary to employ others. And besides, as yet, the divine majesty had not yet taken up the residence in that Holy of Holies. So that's why the priests were in there, not just the high priest. By the way, those big cherubim wings that I was talking about, 20 cubits, 4 wings, each of 5 cubits for a total of 20 cubits, which is a long way. That's 30 feet worth of wings. Those are not the mosaic cherubim who were molded into the mercy seat on top of the ark. Those are there too. So now there's 4 cherubim in the new temple. The 2 little ones on the ark in the middle, and then the 2 big wide cherubim stretching from wall to wall. Now let's get into verse 8. Let's talk about the poles. These poles that were so long their ends could be seen from the holy place, those are the carrying poles that the Levites would use to carry the ark. They were stuck through hoops on the sides of the ark, or rings on the sides of the ark. These poles were not removed and stored them away, and that would have been logical. The ark no longer needed to be moved. However, that would have contradicted Exodus 25:15. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be removed from it. Now, I just finished saying in the tabernacle, the poles were removed from the ark. Exodus 25:15 says the poles shall not be removed from the ark. I think that Exodus 25:15 is talking about when they travel, they're not supposed to remove the poles from the ark. I don't think that meant when they put it into the tent. I could be wrong, but at any rate, probably because of that verse, Solomon and his builders left the poles into the ark beneath the wings of the big cherubim there, the cherubim. Now let's take up a monumental, weighty issue here. How was the ark placed? Did it run east and west so that the narrow end is facing the door to the holy place outside of the Holy of Holies? Or was the ark facing north-south so that when you looked into the Holy of Holies, you saw the broad side of the ark? Well, the public commentary says north-south. Now, this is going to get so complicated that I'm going to tell you what I think. I think the public commentary and a couple other commentaries have got it right, and a bunch of other ones have got it wrong, but they dispute each other and argue with each other and are divided so much because there's a lot of confusion here. So I'm going to take the pulpit commentary solution. They say the ark was running north to south, sideways. Here are three reasons why. The first reason is, verse 7 says that the ark and the poles were covered by the wings. Well, if the poles are sticking from west to east coming toward the door of the Holy of Holies, the wings aren't going to be covering the poles, are they? The poles are going to be extended out of the plane of those angels' wings, those cherubim wings. But if the ark is going north to south, the poles are running alongside the side of the ark where they're going to be under the wings. So that clinches it for me just with one reason. Let me emphasize that verse 7 actually does say that. It does say that the wings overshadowed its carrying poles. Let me read it again, leaving out the irrelevant places, words. The cherubim spread their wings and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. Let me read it again, leaving out more words. The cherubim overshadowed its carrying poles. The ark's carrying poles. Well, the only way that's going to happen is the ark is going north to south. Now, I know this is not going to increase your closeness to the Lord and your holiness and your sanctification, but it is an interesting question. Another reason why the ark is and the poles are running north to south is because if the poles were running east to west, the poles would have stuck out right in front of the ark, and that would have interfered with the high priest's duties as he came before the ark on the Day of Atonement to do his blood sprinkling and such. How's he going to do it? The poles are going to be right sticking in his gut. Reason number 3, the cherubim on the mercy seat would be unbalanced. Now, these are the two little cherubim that are on the ark, on the mercy seat on top of the ark. If the ark is turned end to end, east to west, narrow side sticking toward the door, well, that means you're looking at the back of one cherubim, but the front of the other cherubim, or the other cherub, that other cherub is in the far back and hidden. You can't see him. So I think those are three darn good reasons why the ark is running north to south under those big cherubim angel wings. Now, there's other commentators who disagree with that. They say the ark was running east to west with the poles sticking out toward the door. Jameson Fawcett and Brown said this way, and this way the poles would guide the high priest to the ark in the dark when he goes to do his duties on the Day of Atonement. Matthew Poole says, to the contrary, quote, they that serve to guide him to the mercy seat, the poles, that they, the poles, serve to guide the high priest to the mercy seat is of course mere conjecture and as such of no weight. So he poo-poos that idea. And another argument for that the poles are running east to west, and the ark is also, of course, running east to west, is that it is only in this way, running east to west, that the ends of the poles could be seen in the holy place, as it says in verse 8. Well, we're going to talk about that. I'm going to show you there's a lot of ways we can interpret that so that the poles could be running north to south. I'll just leave it there for right now and say that, to me, it's a slam dunk. The ark is running north to south. We're going to assume that the poles ran along the sides of the ark, not the ends of the ark, but the long sides of the ark, as Matthew Poole says. Now, let's get to another problem in verse 8. The poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place. Oh boy. Now here's where the fun begins. Before we begin, I'm using the NIV translation here. The poles could not be seen from outside the holy place. The holy place is not in the original text. So the original text reads that the poles could not be seen from outside. Doesn't say outside of what. All right, keeping that in mind, let's look at our problem here in the first part of verse 8. The poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary. Now, the NIV has holy place capitalized, so they say it's the 40 by 20 room there to the east of the Holy of Holies. In front of the inner sanctuary, that's the Holy of Holies. So the ends could be seen from the holy place. Now, if you take it that way, as the NIV does, you got a problem. How can you stand in the holy place and look inside the Holy of Holies to see the ark and its poles? Because there's a veil and a bifold door that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. How can you see through the door? Well, you can assume either way, whether the poles are running east to west or north to south. Here's how we can solve that problem. First, perhaps the door is always open, never shut. That's probably unlikely. John Gill has an interesting solution. He says the poles were seen, but they weren't seen in the holy place, as I just said, in the capital H, capital P, holy place. Rather, the poles were seen in a little h, little p, holy place that was in front of the ark. In other words, it was a special place in front of the ark that was specially holy because you're standing in front of the ark. And so you would then read the verse this way, verse 8. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from that little h, little p, holy spot in front of the Holy of Holies, but not from outside. In other words, once the high priest walks into the Holy of Holies, he's standing in that little holy spot in front of the inner sanctuary, and he can see the poles there. Well, that's nice. I mean, that'll work. Of course, there's a little problem here. How can you see the poles when you're standing in front of that holy spot, little h, little p, holy spot in front of the ark? Because it's dark in there. Well, I guess Gill doesn't mention that, but I guess he could answer that by saying, well, once a year when the high priest entered, he opened the curtain and the door to get in there, and that would let light in. So that would save his option. All right, here's option number 3, is how you can see the poles in the holy place. This is the Jewish rabbi solution. The ends of the poles weren't really seen, at least nakedly seen. Rather, they projected into the curtain and so made two visible protrusions. I mean, really, John Gill quotes the rabbis and says this, these poles, also pushing against the veil, might be seen prominent like the breast of a woman under a covering, as the Jews express it. I can't believe the Jews in the medieval times are talking about poles looking like the breast of a woman under a cloth, and John Gill quoting that in the 1700s. I thought back then people had modesty. But, I mean, really, do we really think that the poles are going to be sticking through the curtain? That architecturally and from an interior design point of view just doesn't cut it with me. That also assumes that the ark is moving east to west so that the poles are sticking out toward the door. And as I just said, that's extremely problematic. I don't believe that. And the public commentary adds another problem. The poles would have to be very long and lengthened, actually, to even get to the door. So I think the Jewish rabbi solution is a no-no, a non-starter. Now, the best solution, this is from the pulpit commentary in Colindale, it's the best solution in my humble opinion, is that once a year a gleam of light entered when the curtain was drawn for the high priest. Now, even assuming that the ark is moving north to south, this works. It also works if you translate the holy place in verse 8 as referring to the real holy place, capital H, capital P, holy place, and not a little holy spot in front of the ark, as John Gill has it. It just works. So let me read verse 8 again using the pulpit commentary and Colin Delitzsch's solution. These poles were so long, these poles that were running from south to north, so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place once a year when the high priest opened up the curtain, probably opened up the left side first. The light would go in there, and the light would then strike the northernmost pole so that the ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary. And this, of course, in front of the inner sanctuary means at the doorway of the Holy of Holies when the high priest opens the curtain and lets the light in. But in the second part of verse 8, but the poles could not be seen from outside. In other words, not from outside. And remember, the holy place is not there in the original text. So it could be not from outside the Holy of Holies. That, my friends, is my solution, and I'm sticking to it. But boy, you ought to see the commentators dispute on that. If you want to get a PhD in biblical studies, maybe, or write a paper or something, that might be something that you might like to consider. But as far as whether it will make you more holy, I doubt it. All right, to continue to beat this dead horse, let's look at this outside. The poles could not be seen from outside the holy place. That's in verse 8, NIV translation. Well, here's some options as to what is being referred to here. The poles could not be seen from outside the holy place. If you put holy place there and speculate that it's there, the Holman Christian Study Bible does that, by the way. Well, no, they don't. I take that back. Forget that. Let me just start over here. If the poles could not be seen outside, and you take the blank there to be the holy place, well, then the outside, the holy place, could refer to the porch to the east of the holy place. This is Barnes and Colin Delitzsch say that. Matthew Poole disagrees with that and says, for that they should be seen without, outside the holy place, i.e. in the court, the courtyard, which is where the porch was going into. That was so ridiculous a conceit that it had been absurd to suppose it. In other words, he thinks that Barnes and Colin Delitzsch are just absurd. Well, perhaps they are. Or the holy place could be Holy of Holies. Of course, remember, there's nothing there. It's a blank. It's not in the text. So you can assume Holy and Holies. Well, that fits well with the pulpit commentary and Colin Delitzsch's solution, which I just gave you. The ark and the poles are moving north to south. The priest opens the left door, left side of the curtain, to let the high priest in. Now the ends of the poles can be seen from the gleam of light that goes through the door, but the poles cannot be seen outside. Full stop. Can't be outside of the Holy of Holies. The poles are still there today, verse 8 tells us. Adam Clark says, this proves that the book was written before the destruction of the first temple, but how long before, we cannot tell. Well, but there's still a problem here. Let me read you from Wikipedia concerning the dates of the composition, or the possible dates of the composition of the book of 2 Kings. The date of its composition was perhaps sometime between 561 B.C., the date of the last chapter, 2 Kings 25, when Jehoiachin was released from captivity by evil Merodach, and 538 B.C., the date of the decree of deliverance by Cyrus the Great. Well, both of those dates, 561 and 538, are after the destruction of the temple in 586. So after the destruction of the temple, you're not going to be able to see the poles anymore in the Holy of Holies. So we got a problem here, especially when we go to 2 Kings 25:9 and read this. He burned the Lord's temple. That would be Nebuchadnezzar. Burned the Lord's temple, the king's palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He burned down all the great houses. Well, if the temple's burnt down, how can you still see the poles in the Holy of Holies? Well, three commentators I read solved it this way. Whoever wrote the book of Kings, I think it's probably Jeremiah, but whoever he was, he has copied the words he found in the manuscript he was using. This is the pulpit commentary. Barnes and Ellicott solved the problem that way. Verse 9 says, there was nothing in the ark except the tables of the covenant, the law. Adam Clark says this, quote, we have no proof that, even in the time of Solomon, the golden pot of manna or the rod of Aaron was either in or near the ark. Somehow they got lost. You would think they would have kept up with that as they moved the tabernacle around, but apparently not. Or as they moved the ark around, for that matter. Maybe the Philistines got those elements. Who knows? We go to 1 Kings 8, verses 10 through 13. When the priest withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord. And the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. Now in verse 10, when it says the priest withdrew from the holy place, that could be the holy place, the capital H, capital P, 20 by 40 cubit holy place, or it could be the Holy of Holies, some people say. The cloud filled the temple of the Lord. Gill and Clark say that's both the Holy of Holies and the Holy of Place, and the court, for that matter. Everybody saw the Shekinah glory of God. Just like in Exodus 40, verse 34, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, that's the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So, in both cases, with the dedication of the tabernacle, the dedication of the temple, God showed his presence there by filling the temple up with his glory. Now, right before the Shekinah glory filled the temple of Solomon here, we can read in 2 Chronicles 5:12 what happened. Gill summarizes it by saying this, quote, in 2 Chronicles 5:12, it is said that at this time, the Levites, who were singers of the families of Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun, arrayed in fine linen with their musical instruments in their hands, stood at the east end of the altar of burnt offering, and 120 priests, blowing their trumpets, praised the Lord together with one sound, declaring his goodness and his mercy, which endure forever. This Shekinah glory, of course, is a sign that God has accepted what Solomon had done with his temple there, of course, because he wouldn't have showed up if he was unhappy with the situation. Verse 11, the priests said that they could not perform their service. That's either because of the darkness that was all around, because of the Shekinah glory in the temple, everybody, everywhere else is dark, and so they couldn't see what they were doing. Or maybe the light that broke out of the temple dazzled the priests so that they were dumbfounded by the light that they saw. Or maybe it's because of the psychological terror that struck their minds as they saw all this. This is all speculation. Who knows? But they weren't doing any normal priestly stuff now that God had showed up. The glory of the Lord filled his temple. And of course, all this is a type of the church. The Shekinah glory of God, the Holy Spirit of God, fills his church, which is the temple of the Lord in the new covenant. Now, in verse 12, we read this. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. Now, that's a strange saying here. Why did he say that? Well, it was to keep the people from being frightened. This Shekinah glory showing up is not a sign that's an ominous sign of evil. Rather, it's a token of approval. And so Solomon is reminding the people, look, God has said in the past that he dwells in a cloud. So this is God. Don't worry about this. This is a good thing, not a bad thing. Well, when had the Lord said he would dwell in a dark cloud? I'm going to give you four verses showing God dwelling in a cloud, Exodus 14, verses 19 through 20. And the angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, I believe that's Jesus, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. The pillar of cloud, that's Shekinah glory. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. So there was a cloud at night. Cloud is typically dark, but it was shining. Well, Solomon said the Lord would dwell in a dark cloud. The light shows his dwelling. The cloud is what the light shines out from. Here's a verse that's probably even more clear than that. Exodus 20, 21. And the people, this is at the giving of the Ten Commandments, and the people remained standing at a distance as Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. So God is dwelling in a thick, dark cloud on Mount Sinai. Leviticus 16:2, the Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he may not come whenever he wants into the holy place behind the veil in front of the mercy seat on the ark, or else he will die, because I appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. Deuteronomy 5:22, the Lord spoke these commands in a loud voice to your entire assembly from the fire, cloud, and thick darkness on the mountain. That's referring to the giving of the law. So God lives in a dark cloud. That was well known to Solomon, obviously, and he's reminding the people, God lives in this cloud. Don't think there's anything spooky happening here. Don't worry about it. Solomon goes on to quote, God is saying this in verse 13, I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. I suspect he's referring back to 2 Samuel 7:12, Nathan's prophecy to David. Well, actually, 2 Samuel 7:13, Nathan's prophecy to David. He will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That sounds pretty much like an indirect quote here that Solomon is quoting Nathan. This magnificent temple, which Solomon takes as the house that God would build for his name, in 2 Samuel 7:13, of course, the house is ultimately fulfilled in the house of the Christian church that is filled with the Shekinah glory of the Holy Spirit. But Solomon is taking it to refer to his temple. He also, as Nathan said in 2 Samuel 7:13, I, God, will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Nathan, referring to God, says that I, God, will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Solomon says in 1 Kings 8:12 here, this will be a place for you to dwell forever. So Solomon is quoting Nathan, 2 Samuel 7:13. Of course, that forever would be in contrast to the movable status of the tabernacle. This was a hope of Solomon that this temple would be established forever, but we know in this life there ain't nothing forever. The temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. We go down to 1 Kings 8, verses 14 through 21, and we will finish this audio. While the whole assembly of Israel was standing there, the king turned around and blessed them. Well, let me just stop there. He was looking at the Shekinah glory in the temple, facing west as he looked into the temple, and then he turned his back to the temple, and he faced the people looking east. and then he blessed them. Now, here's some examples of when people were blessed by their leaders. The high priest pronounced the famous Aaronic blessing upon the people, Numbers 6:24-26. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Sounds like the Presbyterian church I grew up in. I never realized that was an Old Testament Aaronic priestly blessing that was being given there. So the high priest blessed the people. Moses blessed the people when he had seen that the people had done all the work of the tabernacle. Exodus 39:43. And Moses examined all the work, and behold, they had done it, just as the Lord had commanded, as they had done. So Moses blessed them. David blessed the people when the ark had been brought into the city of David, Mount Zion, when the ark had been brought in, and the burnt offerings and the peace offerings had been completed. Then David blessed the people in the name of the Lord, 2 Samuel 6:18. And when David had finished offering the burnt offering and the peace offering, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. Moving now to verse 15, then he, Solomon, said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his own hand has fulfilled what he promised with his own mouth to my father David." Now this, of course, is through Nathan the prophet. I've mentioned this prophecy so many times, I'll read it again. 2 Samuel 7:12-13, "When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you," that would be Solomon, "who will come forth from you," that would be Solomon, "and I will establish his kingdom," that would be Solomon's kingdom. "He shall build a house for my name," Solomon shall, "and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." And it was established spiritually, of course, to be fulfilled in the antitype of the church. That's what forever means. Literally, physically, it wasn't forever because the Babylonians wiped out David's house in 586 BC. So Solomon, verse 15, is referring back to the God of Israel, who has fulfilled by building this temple, by allowing me to build this temple, he's fulfilled what he promised. In other words, that there would be, well, here's what he says, "For he said," Solomon continues, and he's referring to God. He says, "For God said," verse 16 now, "Since the day I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I have not chosen a city in any tribe of Israel to have a temple built for my name to be there, but I have chosen David to rule my people Israel." Now, verse 15, "God said this," Solomon quotes. Well, Solomon, this is not an exact quote. Solomon is quoting a passage from 2 Samuel 7:6-7, somewhat loosely, freely. Let me read that. 2 Samuel 6:6-7. "From the time I," that's Yahweh, "brought the Israelites out of Egypt until today, I have not lived in a house. Instead, I have been moving around with a tent as my dwelling. In all my journeys with all the Israelites, have I ever asked anyone among the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, 'Why haven't you built me a house of cedar?'" Well, in that passage in 2 Samuel 7:6-7, "moving around with a tent," "I have been moving around with a tent," God says. Well, that jibes with the passage here in 1 Kings 8, which says, "I have not chosen a city." I've been moving around with a tent in Samuel. I have not chosen a city here in Kings. That's the same thing. And in Samuel, we see that God says in verse 7, "Have I ever asked anyone whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel?" In other words, the king. That jibes with, "I have chosen David to rule," here in 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Chronicles 17:4-14 is the parallel passage to 2 Samuel 7:6-7. So that's basically a loose quote by Solomon to what God has been saying through Nathan the prophet again in 2 Samuel 7. Verse 17, Solomon continues, "My father David had it in his heart to build a temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel." Verse 18, "But the Lord said to my father David, because it was in your heart to build a temple for my name, you did well to have this in your heart." Now, this is not a verbatim quotation again, as the pulpit commentary says. Divine approval of David's intent to build a temple was implied in 2 Samuel 7:11-16, that famous prophecy of Nathan to David. Let me read verses 11-16, and we'll see how God is happy with David, even though he doesn't say specifically, "I'm happy with you, David, because you wanted to build a temple." But it does say this, 11-16, "Ever since the day I ordered judges to be over my people Israel, I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord declares to you, the Lord himself will make a house for you. When your time comes and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up after you your descendant," that's Solomon, "who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me when he does wrong," which Solomon did all the time. "Too many wives, too many concubines. When he does wrong, I will discipline him with a human rod and with blows from others. But my faithful love will never leave him. As I removed it from Saul, I removed him from your way." In other words, Solomon's kingdom lasted as long as he lived. Of course, it got split after he died, and then it was destroyed by the Babylonians ultimately. But while Solomon's alive, God's faithful love never left him. Verse 16, you're referring back to David, your house and kingdom will endure before me forever. Again, spiritually it did. And your throne will be established forever. Yes, the throne of David is established forever because Jesus, the antitype of David, the new covenant David, is seated on that throne right now as I speak. Well, that sounds like God is happy with David, does it not? Even though it doesn't specifically say he's happy with David building a temple, but he says his descendants are going to build a temple. Pulpit commentary says that God's express approval may have been given through Nathan to David at that time. Nathan might have said, David, you did a good thing wanting to build the temple, but it's just not recorded. As the pulpit commentary says, the narratives of Scripture are necessarily greatly condensed. Verse 19, God has continued to speak to David. Nevertheless, you are not the one to build the temple, but your son, who is your own flesh and blood, he is the one who will build the temple for my name. Now, Solomon is quoting there 1 Chronicles 22:8. This is David speaking, but the word of the Lord came to me, came to David. Quote, you have shed much blood and waged great wars. You are not to build a house for my name because you have shed so much blood on the ground before me. Verse 20, the Lord has kept the promise he made. I have succeeded David my father, and now I sit on the throne of Israel, just as the Lord promised. Again, going back to Nathan's prophecy to David. And I have built the temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. I have provided a place there for the ark, and which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of Egypt. And of course, the covenant of the two tables of stone, which managed to be preserved there in the ark. The two tables of the law, of course, are called the covenant because they had the Ten Commandments written on them. I need to go back and pick up something in verse 16 because I skipped it by mistake. Solomon is still speaking. He says, he's quoting God, he's quoting Yahweh. I, Yahweh, have not chosen the city in any tribe of Israel to have a temple built for my name there. Well, God actually didn't say that directly. Again, this is an indirect quote. God did give hints by Moses that there was a place which he should choose. And the implication of that is until they got to that place, then God has not chosen a place for the tabernacle to dwell. That's what Solomon is referring to here. We read this in Deuteronomy 12:5. But you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes. Of course, it's not named in the law, but we know from history that it ended up being Jerusalem. To establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. To establish his name there for his dwelling. Well, now Solomon says, I built a temple for God's name. He says that in verse 20. I have built the temple for the name of the Lord of God. I have built the temple for the name of the Lord. Deuteronomy says that God will establish his name there for his dwelling. So Solomon built the temple for the name of the Lord, and God says, I'm going to establish my name there for my dwelling. So you see, that's pretty close. Actually, it says in 2 Chronicles 6:6 that Jerusalem was, it explicitly says that Jerusalem was chosen. 2 Chronicles 6:6, but I have chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there, and I have chosen David to be over my people Israel. All right, on that happy note, we're finished with 1 Kings chapter 8. Verses 1 through 21. In our next audio, I'm going to take up 1 Kings 8:22 through 53, Solomon's prayer of dedication. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.